Okay, thank you. So I had a short chat with Arjen Lenza of Crypto, and I basically said, why don't you send an email to the organizers, and so the organizers then invited me for giving a talk, and I'm very glad the organizers invited me. So since this is a workshop, I'm going to talk as a workshop. This is not finished work. And so there will be other problems there, etc. And also question things that people take for granted and all this type of stuff. And so I'm actually supported by the EPSR, partly also by the EPSRC. And I'm also a coach professor at Florida State. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to start with the role of Diffie-Hellman assumptions in modern cryptography. And when you start looking at that, it's quite amazing how often that we use Diffie-Hellman assumptions. And so therefore, the question is Diffie-Hellman secure? This will be primarily a short survey. I also will put a question there, which I've been thinking about recently, as some of you know. And then I think I will talk about why we need an alternative. And this will be a very, very informal statement. Extremely informal. Then the question is, can we use factoring as an alternative to Diffie-Hellman? And the answer will be kind of and no. And so then the question is, can we make, which is the main topic of the talk, can we make a trapdoor-free variant of RSA? That means, in RSA, anybody who computes N knows a trapdoor, which is good for certain applications, but not good for other applications. But if Diffie-Hellman is not secure, then this may be a good alternative. And so I'm going to propose the first approach. And the first approach is, once you see and you analyze, it's trivial to break. It's really, really trivial to break. And so then I'm going to propose a second variant, okay? And I'm going to put a question mark there, is it a secure solution? And I think it's a secure solution, but the question then becomes, how practical is it? So that will be the open problem, which I will pose then. What parameters do you have to choose so that it becomes practical and it doesn't fail as the first approach? So if you look at the role of Diffie-Hellman, and I'm not going to do a full survey of that, in modern cryptography, and let's first consider the decisional Diffie-Hellman and the computational Diffie-Hellman. And if you look at practical cryptography, we see that it has been used quite a lot. It was originally introduced by Diffie and Hellman in the context of key distribution. Then the Ingmar Song and co-authors proposed it for group key distribution, which was later, much later actually, reinvented by, I think, Wagner and Zudig. And if you look at privacy, then, oops, have been pushing too many times? No. We have basically El Gamal, which relies evidently on the Diffie-Hellman. And we have a lot of use of El Gamal in, for example, many voting schemes. In particular, all modern mix proposals that I'm aware of, they use El Gamal. And if not all modern ones, then it's almost all modern mix proposals use El Gamal as a primitive. Undeniable signatures, a concept proposed by Shaw, after being proposed, was quickly pointed out by Brands that this is actually based on Diffie-Hellman. So then what happened is that in the 90s, primarily in the 90s, we have seen that the Diffie-Hellman assumption, in particular the decisional Diffie-Hellman assumption, has been used in practical proven secure cryptography. So while what we see in the 80s, proven secure cryptography was primarily not practical, by bringing in the decisional Diffie-Hellman problem, it became that now the tool was there for people to go from theoretical proven secure cryptography to practical proven secure cryptography. I'm not saying that everybody is using that in modern applications. I'm just saying that the difference between these schemes, which I'm going to talk about, and the schemes which are used in practice is so small that you could wonder whether it actually would not be better to use these schemes. And some people actually use these practical proof of secure crypto schemes. And I'm only going to give a few examples here. So group key distribution, in the case of a passive adversary, we used the Diffie-Hellman, decisional Diffie-Hellman, and also computational. That was done in 1994. The journal paper only appeared recently of that. So the proof was actually in the pre-proceedings of Eurocrypt in 94. Katz and Jung in 2003 looked at active adversary, and they relied on the scheme. They had a new proof. The proof was actually more complex than the original one for the passive case. For a privacy, there is Kramer-Shupp. I didn't put it here there, but not that long ago. If you look at pseudorandom functions, we have Naur and Reinhold. If you look at rated tracing, there is a paper by myself, Kurosawa, and Yoshida. It says to appear. It's actually based on a paper by Kurosawa and myself, and then by Kurosawa and Yoshida combined, and we are working making this combination into a journal, the paper. And evidently, as you all know, there are many more, but I'm not going, that's not the goal of the talk. Then there are variants of the Diffie-Hellman assumptions. And the examples are Gap-Diffie-Hellman. There are plenty of papers there, and there are actually too many to survey. So I'm at least in the short introduction to this talk. There's the billionaire Diffie-Hellman, which was introduced by Bonnet and Franklin in 2001, which is a very popular assumption. There are less known assumptions as the DHK, which was introduced by Damgaard and then used by Bellard and Palacio in 2004. And I will talk about that dense contribution later on. And what's DHK? I presume not everybody here knows DHK. It was considered for a while to be actually controversial and then came around. So if you're given G and you're given G to the A, and now you can compute a G to the B and G to the AB, then there must exist an extractor that can actually extract from you B. Okay, so that's the DHK assumption. Right now, a G, you could say alpha equal to G to the A. And now the question is, can your output at the, let's say, beta G the B, gamma G the AB, without knowing B. And so the DHK assumption says this is not possible. So it means that if you will be given this and you output that, then an extractor will exist that will actually find B.
Sorry, I don't quite understand.
The what?
I don't quite understand what this means.
So somebody is going to give you a G and a G and a A.
Yes.
In alpha. And now I'm going to ask you to produce a beta and a gamma, such that beta is G to the B, whatever.
Okay,
so and gamma is G to the AB. So basically, both inputs have been raised to B. So now the question is, can you compute that? If I give you a G and a G and a A, can you compute these two extra outputs without knowing B? And so Damgaard introduced it, and then Bellard and Palacio formalized it, and they said no. They said, if you can do that, then having access to your randomness that you used, there is some way that, that an extractor can, using your randomness, extract the B and your input. So this input here and your randomness will be able to output the B. That's the assumption. Okay?
I still can do this if I know A.
No, because you don't know A. The A, alpha and G are given to you, so I choose the uniform random. If you can solve this problem, evidently you can solve that. But then the whole assumption, they all go.
But they solve it for a specific instance. also if G alpha, it's not the same as solving this by any.
You're not choosing.
The what?
What are the quantifiers on B? So you're given, so is the problem given G and G to the A?
Yes, you're given G and G and the A. Yes, you don't know A.
Yeah, but then what? Then what is it?
Then the question is, can you output a G B and a G A B without knowing B?
So for some B.
For whatever B, yes, whatever B.
For B1 equals 1, I can do it. So
no, because you don't B then. No, because that's why you formalize it. When you formalize it, there will be an extractor that will then be able to. If you don't use RMS, you're automatically dead. Okay? So you use an extractor which from your machine will extract that. So you.
Wait, so what's the exact statement?
The exact statement is that if you build your Turing machine, that then there will exist another Turing machine which will have access to the same input as you get and to the randomness that you use. That Turing machine will depend on your Turing machine, and then you'll be able to extract from that peak. That's the assumption.
Does it say that I can output this where it looks as if my D is random? Yeah,
if you have a Turing machine that always outputs G and GA, then evidently the Bellard-Palacio assumption is correct. Okay? Because you can build a Turing machine that will be able to extract one. That's why you have to do it randomly. So that's why this machine that you will use some randomness. It's not sure that it will actually generate this B, but their assumption is that you will have that you. The only way to do it is that your machine, in a bizarre way, knows B. It's kind of related to proofs of knowledge, where you also have knowledge extractors. The concept comes from knowledge extractors from there. Okay, it's not a goal of the talk. Okay. So I'm going to go on. If you want to talk with me afterwards, we can talk about it afterwards. So there has been a lot of work about whether Diffie-Hellman is secured, and I'm only going to give you a very, very short survey. So it seems that Diffie-Hellman assumptions are secure, and there's an equivalence in certain cases between breaking decisional Diffie-Hellman and computing these two programs. For example, look at the paper by Maurer. In 1994, there's a follow-up paper by Maurer and Wolf later on.
Decisional or
computational? They did it computational, but if computational, you see, then you also get decisional. If you can do computational, decisional also goes.
But from decisional, you can get to computing discrete.
Yes.
How do you do that? Another equivalence between computational and
discrete. That's what Bonnet. So I'm saying more C Bonnet surveys is what Bonnet claimed.
Okay.
Okay. So there has been the work on generic groups, and there's, for example, the paper by Shoup in 1997 that demonstrated that in generic groups the DH is equivalent to discrete logarithm. Now for DHK, the problem that people had immediately questions about. Dent also proved the equivalent. If you have generic groups, then the DHK problem is equivalent to discrete log. So there are other positive results, and so Bonnet has a very nice survey paper, and that's why I refer to you for this one here, in which there are many, many more results on the security of Diffie-Hellman. So, since this is a workshop, I think we need to question the security of Diffie-Hellman. And there's a paper by Sheng and Ushiyama in 2002 at CTRSA that suggested to use some lifting to break DDH.
Decision Diffie-Hellman.
And Koblitz and Menes has pointed out this approach is probably flawed. I'm not going to talk about that, I'm just making some remarks. My first remark is that if you look in practice, and if you look, for example, at the results about generic groups, we don't use the general case. What we usually use is either the curves or the integers modulo P for the multiplication. And we know that in that case, there's lots of structure, and that's why the discrete logarithm is much easier there than in the case of the generic groups. Another comment that I'm going to make, if the variant, for example, look at the work by Verheul, of the date pairing is invertible in some sense, which I'm going to describe, then CDH over a prime order subgroup of ZP star becomes trivial. And I said this is a workshop, so I'm going to here discuss some ideas. And these ideas are in some sense similar to the ones by Sheng and Ushiyama, but not exactly the same. So let E hat be a variant of the date pairing, so there exists a point P such that basically if you map it, if you map PP using this mapping, you don't end up into one. Now what I'm going to do, I'm going to define two functions. I'm going to define the function FP, which is basically nothing else than this function applied on PP, and there should have been space here. I corrected that in the tech file, but I didn't run the PDF tech, I see. So then basically, I also define another function here, which is parameterized by the first input of the variant of the date pairing. And then I have here as a second input here its input. Now assume that this function is invertible in expected polynomial time, and that this function is invertible for a non-negligible fraction of points P, then CDH goes. So why is that the case? If we are given G and alpha equal to G in the A and beta equal to G in the B, the question is, can you compute gamma equal to G in the AB? Under both assumptions, how do you proceed? First of all, you're going to put G as the input of the inverse function of F, and you're going to get a point. Okay. Then now what you're going to do is you're going to assume that this function is also invertible. We assume that both functions were invertible. But this time you're going to input alpha, and you're going to get another point, which we call Q1. And you start seeing that if you do the same now, but then plugging in beta, you get Q2, and if you compute the pairing, basically on the bilinear mapping, the modified dead pairing on Q1 and Q2, you get gamma, and you have your output. So the question is, how hard are these functions to invert? So I'm not going to answer that. I'm not going to say that I claim that they are easy to invert. I'm not going to say that at all. But what I'm saying is that it may be worth looking at. So why do we need an alternative? So now, for those of you who basically like to visit museums, if you go to some mineral museums, you will see this thing here, and that's a gold nugget. Okay. So what has a gold nugget to do with this topic? I told you that I would do this in a very informal way. Okay. Say, why do we need an alternative? Now actually, if you look at gold nuggets, they don't come from gold mines. You find them in nature. Gold mines, usually, you don't get gold nuggets. It is another way that you extract gold from it. But anyway, seeing the following sentence, finding the following sentence in the paper, I couldn't resist to put the picture in. And this is a statement by Bonnet in his abstract of AND 1998, decisional Diffie-Hellman assumption is a gold mine. Okay? So here a gold nugget and Bonnet statement that is a gold mine. So, seeing Bonnet's statement, you expect the statement from me, okay? What would I say? So why did I start with the survey? I started with the survey to let you know, and we have seen are later applications of Diffie-Hellman. And so I say the massive use of Diffie-Hellman assumptions is like, what would you guess? Putting all x in a basket. Okay? So I think it's fine to do all these things on decisional Diffie-Hellman and computational Diffie-Hellman and invariants, etc. But what if one day somebody finds a solution and say, there's a problem with that? Okay? A lot of cryptography that we have today is just going to collapse. That does not mean that the discrete algorithm has to be broken, except in the special cases, etc. But I mean, in the case Bonnet has claimed in his paper, it's quite. So, would we be using factors as an alternative? In the 1980s, when people were speaking about proven security, they usually referred to factoring. But if you look at practical proven secure cryptography, very rarely, I'm not saying never, but very rarely is based on factoring integers. What you see alternatives as RSA, quadratic reciprocity assumption, etc. And there is a problem with RSA, it has a trapdoor. So that, therefore, the natural question is there a trapdoor-free RSA variant? Do I expect it to be the same, doing the same thing as Diffie-Hellman? No. Just what I think is we need alternatives to the Diffie-Hellman assumptions. So I'm going now to propose a first variant to RSA, and then I will explain you which I want to be trapdoor-free. Then I will explain you how I can break it. It's actually, once you do the analysis, it becomes trivial to see why I can break it. So a party is going to choose an n which is the product of two primes, and so the uniform non-random odd e between 1 and n, where p and q are primes. And instead of using the function, basically r to the e mod n1 alone, the users will additionally output for the same r, they will output r to the e2 mod n2, where n2 and n1 are close. It means that n2 is equal to n1, and l is small. And I assume that l is positive. And for simplicity, that e2 is equal to e. I see no reason why not to choose e2 equal to e. Then the question is, can somebody construct an n1 and an n2 so that both of these functions are the easy to invert? If that's possible, then we are in trouble. And I will explain to you later that we are in trouble. So, how will this be used, for example, as a probabilistic one-way function? You're going to assume n1 and n2 and e are public. You now are going to have x be an input. The user will first choose an r1 uniform run in the integers model n, and then compute r2 as x minus r1 mod n2. An output, basically, this, and we call this f of x. And you can say certain things about statistical indistinguishability from uniform randomness if you choose it this way. Yes?
What's a probabilistic one-way function?
Probabilistic one-way function is a function in which you don't only, you basically also are allowed to choose randomness.
So you mean it's possible.
But I want it to be of basically the x here, because there's going to be a relation between these two. Okay? So now I'm going to explain you how you can break that. Why this is not trapdoor free. And so what I'm going to do, the question is it possible for someone to construct an n1 and an n2 such that he or she can computationally invert f1 and f2? I'm going to assume that Q is larger than B, and that Q is P plus alpha, both are primes, Q and P are primes. And now I want to construct an N2 equal to P prime times Q prime, where basically N2 is equal to N, you could call it N1 plus L, where L is small. This time P prime and Q prime are not necessarily primes. So the question then becomes, can a party choose P and Q, P prime and Q prime, P and Q primes, P prime and Q prime, not necessarily primes, so that this is satisfied? Where basically this L is small, and to analyze that, I'm going to call P prime P plus A and Q prime Q plus B. Okay? If we do that, then we trivially get that the condition P prime times Q prime is equal to N plus L becomes nothing else than that, because P prime is P plus A, Q prime is Q plus B, N is PQ, we have that there, and then L, and basically this is using the distributive law, so we get this, so this cancels with this, so we are left with this in here, which we see here by basically using the distributive law on the A, and using the fact that Q is nothing else than the P plus alpha. So we get here Q equal to P plus alpha, so we go straight from there. This comes from here, this comes from here, and the P and the Q, they disappear. And so now we're going to use distributive law, and we're going to rewrite that in this way. That's not necessary to solve this for all the cases. It's sufficient to show that in certain cases this can be solved. So we're only going to look at sufficient conditions to break this. Since P is large, A and B are small, and alpha relatively small, what we will do is the following. We'll decide to choose B as minus A. Why not? And using this choice, the previous equation now becomes, so if B is minus A, you start to see why I chose that. Boom, this thing is going to disappear. This becomes minus A squared. I bring that over to the other side. I bring that over to the other side. And so that's what you see. You see this equation basically in the unknown A. And the alpha is given, and L, for example, could also be given. And we all know how to solve that. So we basically get this for that. Now, there's a comment. Since P and Q are both prime, and Q is equal to P plus alpha, I can replace alpha with 2k, and then this equation becomes straight this equation here. So now I'm going to use equation 4 to demonstrate that the first proposal is insecure. And I'm going to take a very simple case. I'm just going to take alpha equal to 2, that means k equal to 1, which means that we speak about twin primes, okay? Because that means we have a P and a Q which only differ by 2. And then equation 4 becomes nothing else than 1 plus minus 1 minus L. So why not choose L equal to 1? So it looks very simple now. A is 1, B is minus 1. Obviously, if you analyze that, N plus 1 becomes a square. Okay? So if P and Q are reasonable sized primes, then the one who constructs N might be able to factor N plus L, and then F2 can be inverted in polynomial time. Yes? Sorry.
The fact that if you take P and Q equal to each other, you can factor N. It doesn't
yes.
Only, it doesn't.
So the question then is, are there other examples? Yes. There may be. So in general, the trivial generalization is if I choose A equal to K and B equal to minus K, then I can also basically do that, even if B and Q are not close to each other. Okay? So as I said, once you do all this analysis, then afterwards you say, oh, but this is really trivial, because this always works this way. Okay? And then L does not need to be small. Okay? And now the question is, so I was discussing this with somebody, but this was basically a lunch discussion without having a real formal. Having the person didn't talk about it for a long time, so that's why I'm not going to mention his name. And so the question was, are this the only case? If you look at equation 4, it's easy to make more examples in which n prime is actually not a square. Okay, so if you look at equation 4 here, now you can plug in some integers there. And so, for example, what you could do is you could take k equal to 5 and l equal to 16, This is just an example, but you all realize there are many, many more. So then you get here, k is 5, so you get here basically 25. This is 16. We all know how these things work, okay? So you start to see that indeed you can make more examples, and then you need, then you can basically compute a and b. You don't end up with squares. We need to find the prime p and the prime the p plus 10, and there are many, many of those. And evidently, the question is, are there infinitely many, which we don't know. This is just an example. So if you don't believe me, this thing is broken. Okay, so this is no good. So is there a way to save this thing? Intuitively, it looks that if you have enough numbers n, then eventually you will not be able to factor them all. So what I'm going to do is, instead of using just two moduli, being n1 and n2, we will use several. And so we'll have ni equal to ni minus 1 plus li, where the li are small. Okay? So we start from an n1, which is the product of two primes, then we're going to add to that an L2, an L3, etc., which are small, and basically my conjecture then is, when h, the number of those, is not too small, then we at least one function which one cannot invert in polynomial time. Okay? That's my conjecture. What's a possible choice for all these EIs? We could make them all the same. And we don't actually require that the GCD of E and phi of NI be equal to 1. And the probabilistic function is nothing else than the one generalized from the original one which we discussed. So now, there's some open problems here. First of the problem is, how many of these n's do we have to generate? If we have too many, then this thing is not practical. Okay, then we can say, okay, throw it out the door. It's no good. So the first question is, can we make h, the number of the ones we have, smaller? The next question is, are there choices for Li which are better than others? Okay, I'm not so sure of that. Maybe not. So evidently, since the algebra is very different, the crypto systems which work with decisional Diffie-Hellman, computational Diffie-Hellman, bilinear Diffie-Hellman, etc., they may no longer work. But as I stated with my basket of eggs, is that I think we rely a lot today on Diffie-Hellman assumptions. And so I think we need to look more at alternatives. And if you look not just at the integers modulo p, but if you look at elliptic curves and the use of it, and supersingular curves and the use of it, we see that Diffie-Hellman and variants of the original decisional and computational Diffie-Hellman problems, that so basically we're building more and 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 more on this Diffie-Hellman and variants. And so if there would be a breakthrough on that, then the more we rely on it, the more we are a problem. So that's basically why I wanted to talk to you. I'm not saying that this is the best alternative. There may be other alternatives. This is definitely, as I said, it's a workshop, and so this is work in progress. This is not a finished product. I have not answered how big we should make H. I have not answered what would be good choices for Li. Evidently, if we can find good choices of Li, then we may make H smaller, then if we don't have two choices for a lie, then we may have to make H quite big. Yes?
So what's an example application of something that currently requires one of the Hellman-style assumptions, but for which your assumption would be sufficient?
Okay, so basically, it's kind of starting from scratch. I realize that, okay? So, there are certain applications that came out of RSA. And what we have seen is that there's been progress. Each time there has been progress in factoring or on the speed log, people were able to match the one or the other. So I do not exclude that something similar may be true, that if you make schemes for the Diffie-Hellman, that we might be able to make variants. I have a particular example in my mind, but since this is with a goal, et cetera, et cetera, I don't want to go into detail. This is unpublished work. We are not actually doing a transformation there, but we're basically proposing two schemes, one for a variant of the RSA, and one for a variant of the Diffie-Hellman. And what happens is usually, today, what we see in cryptography, is when people design crypto schemes, they are happy if they have one assumption. Okay? What I'm saying is, it's always the same. It's not always the same, but there are so many of these kinds of, okay, what do we use? Okay, let's use this is to develop our variant. It becomes kind of the standard assumption with all potentials. If something goes wrong, then we have all the eggs in that one basket, and then we have trouble. So yes, indeed, that's why I say here that these crypto systems may not work, they may no longer work. So I think in the future, we should be starting to be a little bit more careful and see whether we can find other solutions besides the Hellman and the like. And then say, can we make a variant of this, but then not based on the Hellman. Okay. Yes, so I definitely don't have compiler. There's definitely not.
I agree with your observation that we should look for other things. I mean, just assume that quantum computers exist, that we don't have the old systems anymore.
But that's very different from.
Then we have trouble with RSA like assumptions anyway. So then factoring might not be the right way to go.
Okay, so if you look at quantum computers, this is an alternative. But people are not so sure that quantum computers will be around in the short end. And also, what I would like to point out is that I would like to repeat what Hendrik Lemstra said after it was shown by a group in India that primality is in polynomial time. I heard him give a talk in Australia on this, and he basically said that when you look at this result, the result is trivial. And he said it's kind of a shame for the community that nobody observed it before. So then the question is, if there are such easy things that are out there that we don't see, what else is there that we don't know? And so I'm not picking on discrete log, because discrete log, we all know that discrete log seems, in certain cases, harder than the Diffie-Hellman. So I'm not saying Diffie-Hellman will go. I'm just saying we have to be a little bit more careful, and we should not forget that we have had unexpected results being proven. And I just mentioned the one about primality testing. So something may fall out of the sky, and what are we going to do? We have an egg with a basket with all broken eggs. But factoring is also something that we understand. I mean, I'm not saying if you're dealing with quantum computers, we need something else. I fully agree. But there is not much that we can base on. The experience we have with trying to work on post-quantum cryptography is relatively short. Okay? And also, the threat is not going to be around the corner. Now, for Diffie-Hellman, we don't also know whether the threat is around the corner. But the question there is wise to put all the eggs in one basket.
On the other hand, there we have several different instances. what you've been attacking right now was the instantiation with the finite field.
Yes.
And
yes.
There are other ways, like
yes.
the curved groups or the class group of number fields. Each of them has their own problems, but it's not one cryptoprimitive, it's one level higher, it's just a protocol level. So you can attack cryptoprimitive, you can attack the Fibonacci infinite fields, or you can attack the Fibonacci equal of the curves, and not necessarily attack the Fibonacci as a concept.
Yes.
So it's a track with many baskets on it.
Yeah.
So it means one basket breaks, then there's another basket below. Yes, yes. So if you look at, there are already baskets that have broken. That means, for example, if you look at braid groups, that one is already one basket that's broken. So it all depends. Where do you put yourself? Do you put yourself on the optimistic side or on the pessimistic side? For optimists, there is another basket, and we hope that they're not equivalent. Any other questions or remarks?
Yeah. So just in the system you were talking about.
Yes.
I'm just kind of curious, like, what type of maybe assumption you might be able to reduce it to. I mean, it seems that non-uniform adversaries could certainly break this trapdoor thing, right? I mean, like a non-uniform adversary could just have the factoring built into it with all these different things.
But that's the question. Is so yeah, how much? How big do we make H?
I see. Okay.
So
yeah,
H
no,
do it doesn't work.
Yeah. No. Okay, maybe I'll take it offline.
Okay. Any other questions?
I just wanted to make sure that I followed your first slide clearly.
My first slide.
Did you say that computational decision Diffie-Hellman and decisional Diffie-Hellman are equivalent?
No, I didn't say that.
But you were referring to. Yeah, the previous one. What was the equivalence?
No, what I said is that if you look at the paper by Bonnet, then. If you want, I can show you the paper by one, okay? or did I let that go? I think I may have said I don't need it anymore. Okay, unfortunately, I let this paper go.
At least in Marr's paper, it's certainly CDH, and we didn't contemplate DDH. It's hard
yes.
to see how DDH would fit into that.
So, but if you look at the paper by Bonnet, and you can all can get it here. Then he doesn't give a citation to Maurer. So there explicitly he does not give a citation to Maurer, but he basically links DDH for certain cases to this kid locker. There may be a new result that he put there. He put Maurer in the citation at the end, but there specifically is no Maurer. If you want me to bring it up, I can bring it up. You want to see it? Okay, just go and look at that paper. And it's one of the first pages that he basically makes this. It's before he actually discusses the security of the decisional Diffie-Hellman. Okay? You would expect it to be in the section. I think it's in section 2 and not in section 3.